Good morning, everyone. I'm very impressed that you're all here on this Saturday morning so early. Welcome to the kickoff of the theme track. I'm Kristen Shockley. I'm the chair of this year's theme track. As many of you know, each year the current president decides on a theme, and we have a full day of programming devoted to it. So Dr. Tamtastic Allen this year decided on a breakthrough expanding IO psychology through connection. So what we have is we have five different sessions, and the topics are very different, but the common theme is they each get at how we can connect to areas that are even inside IO or outside, or just connect different school of thoughts to help better come up with breakthrough ideas that will keep advancing IO psychology. And we have an incredible lineup of speakers throughout the day. I'm very excited about it. So I'm going to touch just a little bit, very briefly, on the different sessions throughout the day. So you're here now, so you know this is the East meets West session. So we're going to dig into culture here and how we can use expanded cultural knowledge and information about how to assess cultural competencies to help aid understanding people functioning in organizations. Then next at 9 o'clock, we have neuroscience meets leadership. This is some really interesting cutting-edge research in terms of cognitive neuroscience and how that can be applied to understanding effective leadership and psychopathic leadership as well as self-leadership. Then after the coffee break at 11, we have business meets psychology. In this session, we have an IO psychologist from Google as well as someone with a business background. And they're going to be talking about what they've learned in terms of how to speak each other's languages and to make IO more effective in the business world. And then we have the deductive research meets inductive research at 12:30. We have three very well-known method scholars and we'll be talking about the way we typically think is deductive. We sort of have a favorism towards that, but maybe we're overthinking it and maybe we need to incorporate a little bit more of inductive research into that. So they'll be talking about some really interesting ideas in that. And then finally, at the end of the day, at 2 o'clock, we have technology meets application. We have a scientist and a practitioner. Each one is talking about really, really cool cutting-edge technology that they're using to advance our science and practice. Before I turn it over, I have just one more logistical point I need to mention. So those of you who are here for continuing ed credits, it's going to be a little different this year than it has been in the past. Before you attend the whole theme track and you get the credits, this year it's going to be done individually by each session, so that gives you more flexibility. Each session is 1.5 credits, except for the last one, which is one. But that also means you need to sign in and out at that table in the front for each session. So a little bit annoying, but it'll give you a chance to stretch in between if you're staying for the whole day. So with that, I will pass it on to Greg and Daisy.
Good morning and aloha. My name is Daisy Chang, and together with my co-coordinator, Greg Schmidt, for the session, we're very excited because we have a great lineup of presenters for the East Meets West session. I'm very honored to introduce our first presenter, Dr. Alina Connor. Dr. Connor is the Executive Director for the Stanford Center for Social Psychological Answers to Real World Questions, the SPARC. She's a cultural psychologist, and her work really focuses on sort of bringing in social psychological research findings and insights to the real-world setting. And she has partnered up with collaborators in businesses, governmental agencies, as well as non-for-profit organizations to try to help them solve their problems or emergent issues that they're facing with regards to cross-cultural related questions. So without further ado, I'm going to hand the floor to her, and let's give her a warm welcome.
Good morning. The surf was really beautiful this morning, so I really appreciate you choosing this over the water outside beckoning. I'll try to make it worth your while. So thank you for that introduction, and thank you so much for having me here. I am a cultural psychologist. A cultural psychologist is someone who studies how culture shapes psychology and also how we shape our own cultures. And my interest in culture research is research, right? So I actually have a cultural story. I'm from a very exotic and faraway place you may have heard of. It is called Memphis, Tennessee. It's in the Deep South. In my culture, we have elaborate rituals honoring the ghost of Elvis Presley. And I grew up in a working-class community in Memphis, Tennessee, which means I didn't leave the South much as a kid until at the age of 18 I went away to this place, Yale University, the land of the rich, the home of the Yankees, as my family called it. And before I left home, everyone was very worried about this, right, including this woman. This is my grandmother. That's me, if that wasn't already obvious. My grandmother had a lot of advice for me, but not exactly the advice I was looking for. I asked her, what should I study? And she said, I don't really care, as long as you don't marry a Yankee. And then she gave me the sign to hang in my dorm. It said, better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak out and remove all doubt. So this seemed like really good advice to me at the time, actually, because the last thing I wanted to do is bring shame to my family by appearing foolish. And even though I hadn't left the South much, I was aware of the stereotype of Southerners as slow and backward and perhaps a little dim-witted. And the last thing I wanted to do was confirm that stereotype. But when I got to Yale, I quickly realized I was the only person who had been advised to keep my mouth shut because I was surrounded by people who could not stop talking and also telling me how great their ideas were. But meanwhile, I didn't quite know what to talk about. And so I sort of sat in mystified silence for a few years. But then over the time, too, I also realized I wasn't alone. I looked around, and I saw other people who were having trouble speaking up, including my African-American and my Latino roommates who were concerned about confirming negative stereotypes about their groups, and also my Asian and Asian-American classmates, including a woman named Hee Jung Kim, who was from South Korea. I met her here. It's the next step in my educational journey at Stanford University, another fancy elite private college. And Hee Jung and I both were students of Hazel Rose Marcus, a pioneer in cultural psychology. And Hazel really insisted that we speak up in her class. And while I rose to the occasion, excuse me, Hee Jung kind of stubbornly refused. And then one day, Hazel got a clue into why Hee Jung wasn't speaking up. Hee Jung sent her an email, and there was nothing in the body of the email saying anything but this. She had changed her signature line to this: the empty carriage rattles the loudest. So what Hee Jung was trying to communicate to Hazel was her idea that the people who have the least to say are the ones who are talking the most. So Hee Jung, this research is research idea, Hee Jung went on to conduct a brilliant set of studies showing that indeed among Asians and Asian Americans, talking actually interferes with thinking, where for European Americans, talking actually helps thinking. And at the same time, I also became very interested in social class as culture. And my research shows that working class European Americans are less interested in expressing themselves and exerting control and speaking up and having choices. And although Hee Jung's research and my research on the surface look very, very different, at the core, they both programs tap into a similar set of ideas. And one of the ideas is that people from different cultures are supposed to be cultivating different sides of their self. So in the classrooms that Hee Jung grew up in, you were supposed to sit quietly and listen to the teacher and incorporate what the teacher was saying into how you already think. And certainly the last thing you would do is challenge the teacher. Whereas the classrooms that many European Americans grew up in look something like this, where you're competing for the teacher's attention so that you can express your uniqueness, express your individuality, exert control, and maybe even influence the teacher. And in classrooms like this, we learn very early this idea: the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? But in the classrooms that Hee Jung grew up in, they learned this: the duck that quacks the loudest gets shot. So with those ideas in the classroom about thinking and talking, these different ideas about the self, Hee Jung and I and many other researchers look at how many cultures want us to be interdependent. They want us to use this side of ourselves that relates to other people, that finds our similarities with other people, that seeks to adjust to other people, and that wants to be rooted in tradition, place, and history. And this is what my grandmother wanted. This is probably what Hyejung's grandmother wanted. This is a self that has a porous boundary that makes other people a part of the self. Our relationships are the focus. But places like elite institutions within the U.S. and the U.S. mainstream culture want us to use this other side of ourself, which is the independent side. That's the side that seeks to be individual, different, unique, influencing, controlling other people, controlling the situation, and rather than rooted in tradition, place, and history, free from those constraints. And these are both equally wonderful ways to be, and all of us have both sides to these to ourselves. But when people who tend to use their independent side come into contact with people who tend to use their interdependent side, conflict often ensues. And Hazel and I, in our recent book, recount how that fundamental conflict between independence and interdependence drives some of the most heated conflicts in our world today, including conflicts between East and West, men and women, whites and people of color, middle class and working class, the East and West Coast versus the South and Midwest within the U.S., mainline Protestants versus conservative Protestants, Catholics and Jews, even businesses versus nonprofits and governments, very different cultures. And once again, at the global level, global North versus global South. So to the topic of East versus West clashes, that's not a new clash, right? There have been fundamental differences between these two cultures for a long time. The clash that Hazel and I are very interested in is this one, that Asian Americans are 5% of the U.S. population and growing, and fill 15 to 45% of undergraduate seats at top universities, and yet are only 1.4% of Fortune 500 CEOs and only 2% of the U.S. Congress. So some people have described this problem as hitting the bamboo ceiling. Just as women hit the glass ceiling, Asian Americans, for some reason, are underrepresented in the higher echelons, the highest echelons of government and business. Excuse me. Sort of cough. So why is that bamboo ceiling there? Of course, there's a lot of reasons that we think this clash of independence and interdependence is at play. And here's what we think is going on. In Asian cultures, leading requires fitting in and listening and remaining calm. Because when you do those things, you're actually able to attune to your coworkers, your employees, and adjust to them and come up with strategies that are appropriate to your workforce. As opposed to in the U.S., we have a notion of leading being standing out and taking talking and getting excited. And this is how you show your unique ideas and your new take on the problem and lead with your charisma, right? So this is a very standard idea in management. And the problem then, of course, as you can see, as when your Asian and Asian American coworkers and employees come up for review or evaluation or promotion, it's hard to recognize what their contributions have been because they're not leading in the way that you're expecting and according to the ways that we've defined leadership. Excuse me, sorry. So, let's take a moment. Like, how do we know this? How do we know that Asians tend to use their interdependent self while Westerners tend to use their independent self? I mean, doesn't that sound like a stereotype from the 1950s? And isn't the world getting smaller? Aren't we all becoming more alike? The answer to both of those questions is actually yes. It is a cultural stereotype. And yes, the world is getting smaller. Nevertheless, in our book, we recount hundreds of studies demonstrating that there are these strong and robust psychological differences between people from Asian backgrounds and people from with European heritages. So here's an example. Actually, I'm going to do this one. Imagine that I have you've just completed a survey, and in exchange, I'm going to give you a free pen. This is your compensation for participating in my study. Which pen do you choose? Don't think about it too much. How many of you want the green one? Okay. And how many of you want the orange one? Okay, I always choose orange because it's my favorite color. I know that's not obvious. But But this study has been replicated using different color pens and different numbers of pens and different cultures, different contexts. But the general finding is that Asians and Asian Americans will go for the majority color pen, and European Americans will go for the less common pen, the unique pen. Once again, this very simple act showing a preference for uniqueness versus fitting in. So why is that, right? Is this a biological difference or is this a cultural difference? There are people who argue that it's biological in some way, but in our book we present, I think, ample evidence of all the cultural forces that lead one group of people to choose interdependence and another group that choose independence. Which begs the question, what is culture? So, sorry, my slides are not properly proportioned. There are hundreds of definitions of culture, each one more complex than the one before. We have a very simple definition, which is that culture is the ideas, institutions, and interactions that guide people's thoughts, feelings, and actions. So putting it all together into this is how culture works. You can see that each of these levels of culture starts with an I. This is a mnemonic device. We're trying to make this memorable. On the left-hand side, we have individual selves, your thoughts, your feelings, your actions. So, for instance, in the Asian culture cycle, the notion that you are supposed to choose similarity and conformity as opposed to sticking out would be an individual psychological tendency. At the interaction level are our interactions with norms and cultural artifacts. So, for instance, in Asian classrooms, teachers who encourage you to figure out how you fit in with other people and how to accommodate other people, that would be a daily practice that encourages interdependence. Daily interactions are nested in institutions. These are our scientific, philosophical, religious, educational bodies that drive the kinds of interactions that are more or less likely to happen, drive the kinds of psychologies that are more or less likely to happen. So, in Asian cultures, for instance, philosophical traditions that emphasize following a guru and learning, this is true in Buddhism for sure, learning from your teacher before challenging or going your own way and really following someone else's example. And then the highest level is deep-seated cultural ideas, excuse me, about what is natural, what is right, what is good. So for instance, the idea that your role in life, your goal in life, is to figure out how you fit in the social order as opposed to figure out how to make the social order accommodate you would be a deep-seated cultural idea in Asian culture cycles. So a couple of things to notice. An implication of a cycle is that it's dynamic. It's constantly changing. Another implication of this model is individuals are not outside of culture. We're creating it and we're created by it. So that also means that we can change it. But this dotted line means we can't change ideas directly. Instead, to make cultures change, we have to make changes at the individual and interaction and institutional levels. And once you do that, you set the culture cycle on a different course. So going back to the culture cycle, we've talked about, and I showed you that one study showing the individual level difference. What's going on in the rest of the culture cycle to support these different interdependent Asian cultures? At the interaction level, we talked about the proverbs. Also, mass media are a very potent source of ideas about the good and right way to be. This is in a set of studies done by our colleague Jeannie Tsai. She looked at children's books. So media include everything from video games, children's books, magazines, movies, all the media that send very subtle sometimes, but also very obvious other times, messages about how to be a self. In this set of studies, Jeannie and her colleagues went through all these children's books in the U.S. and Taiwan and measured two things, the number of smiles and the width of the smiles. And what she found is that in the Taiwanese books, the kids were smiling just as much, but look at that smile. It was very serene and calm. Whereas in American children's books, this think Max and Where the Wild Things Are, the big cheesy grin. And this ties to interdependence in that a calm, serene smile is not going to interrupt your ability to pay attention to other people, whereas the big expressive smile, where you're very much focused on expressing your feelings as opposed to attuning to others, these different emphases. You see the same thing in women's magazines, Asian ads, the women have, I think some cultures call it the stretch smile, and others have the Julia Roberts, full-fanged, exultant, wide mouth, gasp of happiness. That's the technical term. At the institution level of the culture cycle, I mean, Madison Avenue and the equivalents in Asian cultures did not make up these cultural scripts about how to be a person. Going back to the institutional level, the guru tradition in many Asian cultures, the Buddha, most representations of the Buddha, we see he's what? Closed-eyed and listening, serene, taking it all in. A major goal of Buddhism is to recognize that the self is a social construction or a mental construction, and to dissolve the self and immerse yourself in other people in the world. The Socratic tradition in the West is all about talking, right? The Socratic method assumes that you already have all the knowledge you'll ever need, and you just need to be able to express it. The role of a teacher is to pull it out of you. So very different cultural ideas about how to learn and how to be and how to think and how to act. Just because these are deep-seated cultural ideas and cultural patterns doesn't mean that you cannot bridge the divide. We suggest a meet-in-the-middle strategy whereby European Americans use more interdependence and Asians use more independence. And we have the second step in parentheses because, at least in many American contexts, Asian Americans are the less powerful group. And so they have less power to change the culture cycle. So focusing first on European Americans, it's not just a nice thing to do for Asian Americans. Research is increasingly showing that interdependence is good for everyone, where groups that stress interdependence perform better than groups that stress independence, and also, I'm sure a lot of you have heard, more ethnically diverse corporations have greater sales, customer bases, and profits. So how do you do this? Just three quick points. Going back to the culture cycle, making change at the institutional level, promote more Asians to leadership positions. I don't know of any studies that have examined the effect of this. I think there's a sample size problem. But one of the big ways to change a culture is to change the leadership. So giving Asians a chance to actually perform at that level instead of discriminating against them is a good way to change the culture cycle. At the interaction level, allowing a variety of contributions to the workplace, not just spoken contributions, but actually allowing people to write their ideas, send them in by email. We also endorse a practice called warm calling. Instead of calling people out of the blue and asking them to respond to a question, giving them a heads up the day before that I might ask you a question and have them prepare for it will actually help Asian students and Asian employees make better contributions. We suggest other techniques in the book. Finally, know yourselves. Not just know yourself. It's very easy to assume that, and it has been historically, that there's something natural, inevitable about white people, about European Americans, that we are people and everyone else has culture. You know, we have, until recently, Band-Aids were this color, as if all people were this color, and the flesh crayon was the color of European Americans. But just knowing that you too are a cultural being with two sides to yourself increases actually the resources you bring to the table to capitalize on the talents of everybody in your workplace and really build the bridges between different and equally valuable cultures. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That was a very interesting kickoff to our day here. I'd like to introduce our second speaker. Let me turn this off so we don't keep it. I'd like to introduce our second speaker. Dr. Michelle Gelfand is professor of psychology and distinguished university scholar teacher at University of Maryland. Her work explores cultural influences on conflict, negotiation, justice, and revenge. The name of her talk today is Cultures Constraints, Understanding the Differences Between Tight and Loose Cultures. So please help me in welcoming Michelle.
Thank you so much. That's okay. Good morning. And thank you very much for coming. We know that it's early and that we're competing for sleep and beach, so this bodes well for East Meets West. I want to just mention, I think speaking to the choir, that we know it's really important these days to understand culture. It's unsurpassed the amount of cross-cultural interaction we have around the world with immigration, with globalization, with pressing concerns that require global and local collaboration, as well as in dealing with conflict and global terrorism, where understanding cultural differences is really a matter of life or death. By way of introduction, in terms of our field, attention to culture in IONOB has really has been increasing at a rapidly incredible rate. I would say that the field has a long past and a short history. Probably the first arguably cross-cultural psychologist was Herodotus, who in his famous book, The Histories, documented a wide range of cultural differences around the world. Fast forward many centuries to another Greek, Harry Triandis, who in his analysis of culture detailed the importance of studying culture and psychology, and really was a pioneer. Many of us stand on the shoulders of people well before us who started the field of cross-cultural psychology that then really merged into IO psychology. And the Handbook of IO Psychology in 1976 had a chapter on cross-cultural IO psychology that's remarkable, that details decades of work in the field. Back then, we really had very superficial understanding of culture. The methodology was limited. But in the last, I would say, several decades, it's just been a revolution in the field. You can't not open up a journal, JAP, JPSB, and not see something on cross-cultural differences. It's pervaded at all different levels of analysis, from the organizational down to the neuropsychological level. We see that culture work is much less the exception and much more of the norm. There's great degree of methodological, multi-level sophistication. And more generally, it's just we should be proud that we're starting to move beyond these kind of weird Western-educated industrial-rich samples in our work. Nevertheless, our field has quite a ways to go, and one of the things that you'll see, and I think many of us have noted, is that our field is exceedingly narrow in its scope, strangely enough, even though we really have a revolution at our hands. And a big part of the problem is that we're obsessed, in a sense, with one dimension of culture that's become basically a catch-all for the field, pointed out by Kachibachi many years ago. I'm guilty of this as well, having worked with Harry Triandis. This is akin to essentially studying one dimension of personality. Let's say that we know a lot about extroversion, but nothing else about many other dimensions of culture. Another issue that you find in the field from a scientific point of view is sort of a tautological problem whereby we equate cultural differences with culture. So we say, you know, these groups are different because they differ in their cultures. And there's very little understanding of how distal and ecological factors relate to everyday situations and psychological processes in a system type of fashion. And I would say that what I've been trying to do in my work is trying to look at neglected aspects of culture, aspects of social norms and social structures and the context, because much of our work has been focused on values, perhaps an individualistic bias, something that exists in the head, versus external constraints. So what I want to do with the short time that I have with you this morning is to try to expand the cultural toolkit, talk to you about some of the work that we've been doing on the strength of social norms and how we model this across different levels of analysis. At the end of the talk, I'll talk about implications for organizations and intercultural interactions. I want to mention that I stand on the shoulders of Pelto, who was the first person to talk about what he called cultural tightness and looseness. And this is essentially the degree to which norms are very clearly defined and reliably imposed. In his work in about 20 traditional societies, he found wide variation with groups such as the Hutterites and Lubara that had very clear norms, very formal, and very severe sanctions for violations from norms. The King Bushmen and the Skolt Lapps, by contrast, had fewer norms, much more informal, and norms were not enforced to the same extent. He speculated that there were certain conditions like population density and kinship structure that helped foster these differences, but this construct kind of got lost in the intellectual map. John Barry and his colleagues tried to also look at this in traditional societies, and same with Susan Carpenter, who differentiated it from collectivism, but until recently there's been very little work on this construct in modern societies. Our goal in this work was to try to see, do modern societies vary on the strength of cultural norms? Why do they vary? What implications does it have for individual functioning? And what kind of implications does this have for cultural clashes? We draw on a very general model of culture that Harry Triandis talked about years ago, wherein he was describing ecological factors and historical events influence the social organization of a country, which in turn affects characteristics of social situations and psychological processes. This seems like a very general model, and the question we have was, well, can we test this? Can we actually collect data and show that tightness-looseness operates, roughly speaking, with these kinds of factors in mind that all interrelate in a very coherent system, even though they operate at different levels of analysis? What we did was we went out with some NSF funding, and we developed a measure of tightness-looseness. You can see some of the items here. And they all refer to the social context. They're not referring to the individual. They're about how strong are the social norms in this context. Are there strong sanctions when people violate from norms? Do people have a wide range of freedom in their everyday situations? Do people comply with social norms in these contexts? And you could see here a rank order of different cultures. We only have a small N of about 33 countries. But what is important to note is that people share their perceptions of the strength of social norms. We have high RWGs and ICCs. This construct is also related to other unobtrusive measures. For example, the percentage of left-hand writers in a country is lower in tight cultures, presumably, sorry for the left-handers out there, because left-handedness is deviant. Tightness scores also relate to accuracy in public clocks around the world. Loose cultures have clocks in cities that vary widely. You're beginning not sure what time it is. Tight cultures have a great degree of accuracy in public clocks. We also showed in a paper where this was published a couple of years ago in Science that this dimension is distinct from collectivism. It's unrelated to GNP and other cultural dimensions. But let me get back to the ecological and historical context of what makes this dimension and these cultural differences make sense. Why are they quasi-functional in some ecological and historical context? And we had a simple assumption. Our assumption was that strong norms and sanctions do something. And what they do is they reduce the range of permissible action to help people to coordinate their social action. And we argued that that coordination function is very important in certain parts of the world. That is to say that coordinated social action is more important in nations that have strong threats for survival. These could be human threats, things like having a lot of conflict on your own territory, being threatened, being invaded on your territory, or having high population density. Or they could be other ecological types of threats, a dearth of natural resources, lots of natural disasters. And our simple premise was that in cultures that have a lot of these threats, they will develop strong norms to function for survival. And this is where I think it's very important as cross-cultural psychologists that we try to think about not just are there differences, but why do they exist? It might be easier to understand why we have such large differences around the world when we can see that they're functional, at least in part, to some ecological and historical context. So one of the first things we looked at with our data was population density. Cultures around the world vary dramatically on population density. Singapore, for those of you who have been there, has about 18,000 people per square mile, as compared to New Zealand, that has about 30 people per square mile. And you can think about when you're in a very high population density context, like an elevator, that you really need to make sure that you don't have a lot of chaotic interactions because you really could step on each other's toes, so to speak. Whereas if you live in a context that has very low density, you don't really need to coordinate your actions so much. And that's exactly what we found. Population density, both modern-day density and also even back to 1500 predicts tightness in our data. We also looked at other kinds of threats, things like natural disasters, lack of natural resources, food deprivation, all of which in traditional societies were shown to require stronger norms for coordination in agricultural types of contexts. And we were able to show with our data that there's a very strong connection, even controlling for things like GNP, between these kinds of threats and tightness. I want to turn to a historical type of condition because what we argued was that nations that have a lot of threat on their own territory need to develop strong norms for cohesion to deal with those kinds of threats. And this was something that Sumner said years ago in political science, over 100 years ago, that the exigencies of war with outsiders are what make peace inside, lest internal discord should weaken the we group for war. And we looked at this idea with our data, and we basically collected through some political science databases the number of times a nation was threatened by its neighbors. So not the amount of international conflict you're engaged in, The U.S., for example, is engaged in a lot of international conflict, but not on its own soil, with some recent exceptions. And what you could see is there's a strong connection between the number of times that you were threatened by your neighbors and tightness, whereas actually what's not presented here is that the sheer amount of conflict you've had in the world is not. So you can also see anecdotally after 9/11 or after the Boston bombing, at least anecdotally, some discourse around should we become tighter, should we have stronger norms. And again, to the extent that you face this chronically, this chronic cultural ecological condition, it makes sense to develop stronger norms to deal with those kinds of threats. I will just, sorry for the visual, but the last threat we also looked at was disease threat. How many pathogens, especially tuberculosis is a very contagious pathogen, it would be very threatening not to have strong rules and sanctions, lest these kinds of things spread and wipe out an entire population. So that was one part of our story. We wanted to look at the ecological and historical foundations of culture. I do want to say that we also now are turning to another level of analysis. How do the everyday social situations vary in tight and loose cultures? This is a level of analysis we rarely look at in the field of IO or cross-cultural. And here what we're interested in simply is a certain dimension of situations that we refer to and others have as strong versus weak situations, something that Walter Mischel has talked about, Goffman, many others. Strong situations limit the range of permissible behavior by really getting everyone on the same situational page, the strong center potential in strong situations. Weak situations afford a wide range of behavior and more improvisation. And I would ask you, what kind of situation is this? I think if I started dancing and singing, or maybe starting letting up a cigarette or calling my daughter to wish her happy birthday, you would look at me askance. And in fact, we could see that in many everyday life, we encounter strong and weak situations on a daily basis. This is a pretty strong situation. But tonight, out and having drinks in Honolulu is a much weaker situation. And we had one simple proposition in this research, which is that all cultures have strong and weak situations, but that tight cultures have a greater preponderance of strong situations. In an analogy, probably an extreme analogy, it's like living in a very, very extreme tight society. It would be like living in a library a lot of your life, where you have to really monitor impulses, be worried about how you're whether you're fitting into the norms, and so forth, whereas in loose societies, you have a much wider range of situations that people encounter on a daily basis that are weaker in their nature. That is also to suggest that the same situation, like being in a library or being in a public park, is constructed quite differently in different cultures, and that's exactly what we found. We asked people in this study how appropriate are 12 different behaviors across 15 situations. So how appropriate is it to burp in a classroom, or eat in an elevator, or flirt in a job interview, or curse in a library. And we were able to construct indices of how strong situations were in each culture. And what you could see, what was really remarkable, was there was a really universal rank order in strong and weak situations. And just by way of example, you could see here that in all these four different, very diverse contexts, job interviews and funeral ceremonies and libraries were very strong, whereas parties, public parks, and bedrooms were very weak. But what you can't see exactly, because the data is too small, is that tight societies had much stronger situations. So, for example, library and classroom are even much stronger in Pakistan than in New Zealand, whereas a party and public park were still much stronger in these contexts, affording less variation in those contexts. I will just say that we also then wanted to look at how does this affect psychological processes? Is there a connection between the chronic nature of situations you encounter, strong or weak, and associated psychological processes? We reasoned that in contexts where there's strong situations, you would have to have a greater prevention focus, you'd have to have higher impulse control, and you'd have to have really more of a focus on the situation, whereas in loose contexts that have a wide range of weak situations, you need to basically have more tolerance for uncertainty. And that's exactly what we found through our HLM analysis. You could see that there's a strong connection between the chronic nature of situations and our everyday psychological processes. So just putting this all together, and then I want to just tell you a couple of new directions in this line of research, you can see this is a multi-level structural equation model that tries to look at across levels of analysis, how do we put all these things together from very distal ecological social factors to everyday recurring situations to psychological adaptations. Now this, of course, is all correlational, so we have to take that with a grain of salt. But it's our attempt to say that we should try to map out the different levels of analysis that constitute a cultural system and show how they're interrelated. They're really different constructs at different levels of analysis. We don't call people tight individuals We look at adaptations to strong and weak situations, which are adaptations in part to the ecological context. Okay, I just wanted to mention a couple of new ongoing extensions that we're really excited about. One of the things that we've been doing is looking to see whether or not this theory applies to other levels of analysis, and we have a new study at the state level that looks at tightness looseness in the 50 United States, and that's coming out next week in PNAS. And you could see in this study that there's quite a bit of homology in terms of ecological and historical conditions and other factors that I just described. And I'm just going to pique your interest in that and email me. I'll send you a copy of this paper. Also, there's quite a bit of work going on now at the organizational level on the concept of tight loose. A recent paper, for example, on stock price synchronicity has been that's coming out in the Journal of Financial Economics has looked at how stocks are more synchronous in tight societies versus loose societies. There's other work on CEO discretion and HRM strength. And then more micro-level processes of leadership and trust, negotiation, and some more recent work that we've been doing on tight-loose transitions, particularly the kinds of personality attributes that are more or less needed when navigating the tight-loose divide. We've also been reaching into other levels of analysis and also trying to deal with issues of causality. So we've been teaming up with some evolutionary game theorists to look at the conditions under which strong norms and sanctions is functional versus not. We've been looking at neurobiological foundations of tightness, particularly through EEG, to the extent that the strength of norms is something that has been developed and reinforced through a system, it would stand to reason that this is reflected in the neurobiological level. How fast do people detect norm violations? How upset are they by them? And so forth. And we've also been doing some work on priming. I want to end with one last point, which is the quintessential question that I get, which is better, tightness or looseness? Many people, as my colleague mentioned in her talk, associate Western culture with being the norm and being the best. And in fact, what we've been finding is a very, really what we would argue is a curvilinear relationship between tightness, looseness, and a variety of outcomes. And we draw on very giant scholars such as Fromm and Durkheim and Etzioni, who also argued in some shape or form that the degree of latitude and constraint in any system has to be balanced, and the extremes of both would really be unhealthy for any society. And that's exactly what we set out to test. And what you could see here, and this is my last couple of slides, is that, in fact, extreme levels of tightness and looseness are both related to low happiness. They're also related to higher depression. They're related to higher suicide. They're related to higher blood pressure. And they're also poorer nations as well. And we believe that this is for different reasons. If you live in a society that has extreme looseness, there's a sense of anomie, there's a sense of meaninglessness. There's really difficult, no mechanisms to coordinate social action. Whereas if you live in a context that's extreme in terms of tightness, this also is something that is overly constraining and unhealthy. We think that this research should be ultimately useful to helping people to understand other cultures, to manage these cultural clashes that we think are happening across the tight-loose divide. As Herodotus, this is my last slide, said, all societies are ethnocentric, but they view other cultures through their own lens. And without the extremes in mind, but in general, tight societies do have some advantages and also what one might say are disadvantages, more order, less crime, but less tolerance and more ethnocentrism. Whereas loose societies have more latitude and tolerance, but they have more crime and they're much higher in terms of their social disorganization and anomie. We believe that, you know, without really understanding where these differences come from, that people stereotype and judge others, and this happens a lot in the international scene, and that we need to start thinking about how to train people to understand why and when these differences are functional in their own ecological historical context. So I think I'll end there and say thank you.
All right, our last but not the least presenter is Dr. Richard Griffith. Dr. Griffith is a professor of psychology at Florida Institute of Technology. He's also the executive director for Institute for Cross-Cultural Management. His most recent work has been focusing on developing cross-cultural competency models, and he has received funding for the Department of Defense to develop training for cross-cultural competency for our military personnel. So without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Griffith.
Thanks, Daisy. I grew up in Ohio, and I did a little bit of fishing, just in ponds around town. But in Florida, you've never seen anything like the fishing culture there. These people live for fishing. So they spend an inordinate amount of money to go buy technology to find these fish, and they'll spend hours running up and down a boat trying to get around obstacles so that they can land the big one. And what happens is usually you see the line break, and they'll wait a week just to get another nibble. And I found that researching cross-cultural competence has this same dynamic, at least for me. It's a really elusive construct be able to get, and the military's thrown a lot of money to try to be able to improve the measurement of cross-cultural competence, and I swear, just about the time I think I get my head around it, I break that line, and it might be another 2 months before I have another cogent thought. But at least when you land a fish, when you get it in the boat, it's pretty easy to measure. You just slap a ruler down next to it, and you know what you got. I wish it was that easy with cross-cultural competence. So my name's Rich Griffith, as Daisy said. I'm the executive director at the Institute for Cross-Cultural Management down at Florida Tech. We try to help companies adapt, prepare, and prosper as they're working out into the global environment. And what I'm going to talk about today is some new theorizing that we're doing in the area of cross-cultural competence, and then just highlight a couple of applications in the area of assessment and in leadership development. So I guess from my perspective, one of the biggest problems that we have in this area of researching cross-cultural competence or using it for a decision-making device is that we're really not measuring what we intended to measure. So you can't figure out how big a fish is if you don't have a fish. And that's one of the real problems, I think, that we're facing in the area of assessing cross-cultural competence is that there's a lot of construct confusion. There's not a lot of clarity in this area. Many, many different definitions. Often you find overlapping definitions or overlapping frameworks that have antecedents, that have competencies, that have performance outcomes, and they're all treated the same. And ultimately, then we're really not taking contextual variables into account very well either. So one of the very first things I think we'll need to do to figure out how big our fish is to start really clearly defining fish before we move forward. Some folks have been doing this. I think that there are some nice frameworks that are beginning to emerge in the area of assessment for cross-cultural competence. Mike McCloskey in 2010 put together a real nice framework that he built from some critical incidents and came out with five meta-constructs that cover this particular area. There's some good work that is done at the Defense Language and National Security Education, blah, 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 Delencio, you know, another alphabet soup from the government. But there's fine folks there, Allison Greensands and Patrice Reed. I put together a good framework, and there's a number of others. Unfortunately, the number's a little too high. It reminds me of a comment from my hero, Bob Hogan, who said, "Griffith, frameworks are like assholes. Everybody's got one." So if you put a bunch of academics in the room, you're going to get a framework. They'll come up with laundry lists of competencies, and unfortunately, those lists aren't very helpful because there's not a lot of theory that underlies that area. So that's something that I'd like to see done a little bit more and a little bit more rigorously in the area of assessing cross-cultural competence and training cross-cultural competence. Pat Converse is a colleague of mine, and he's done some really marvelous work. He led a team that started doing some theorizing, and where the team started was in grounded theory. So we went back and we took a look at all these frameworks that were out there. We popped together a matrix, and essentially what you could see is that they fell under pretty much three umbrellas, or they fell into three buckets. You had some description of competencies, or excuse me, constructs that would lead someone to be motivated or be comfortable in one of these situations. Some of these things were knowledge about specific cultures, and then ultimately there were some ability constructs that were in there. I had a really cool opportunity in the past year to interview some of the human terrain professionals. You've probably heard quite a bit about these folks. They're embedded behavioral scientists that are now going out with infantry groups. And they were used quite extensively in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I got to tell you, it was the most fun I had in a long time. Just beautiful stories that you heard. Some of these stories were heroic stories. Often they were very tragic. Many of them really, really horrific stories. But the one common thread that ran throughout that was that when we asked these individuals what made one troop competent and one not very competent when it came to interacting with another culture, they said it was their commander. That if their commander supported coin operations, those troops were good. And if the commander said culture was an important subject to learn, those troops got very good at it. And all of a sudden it hit me, wait a minute. Culture, in that instance, motivation is taken out of the equation. It's a constant. So we kind of removed that from our view. Knowledge is easy. We've been doing that for a long time. We've been getting troop smart cards since we were able to print. And if you want to run out and get do's and don't books, they're all over the place. Now my sense is they're not always that helpful because you can't keep that stuff in your head. When you're in the moment trying to interact with somebody, I don't know what to do with my left hand. I can't remember what to do with my feet. I don't know where my tongue should be. So, it's kind of hard to handle that stuff, but we've got a good grip on it, and we have resources. And what that left us with was the ability constructs. And I'll be damned, when we looked at them, 100% of the ability constructs fell under the umbrella of self-regulation. So self-regulation is really the ability to inhibit behavior or activate behavior. Some folks think about it as a trait. Often there's other models that are more process models or resource models of self-regulation. And what Pat Kronvers did, I thought, was really kind of a neat approach. He took an event-based approach to looking at cross-cultural competence. So what happens when two different people from different cultures meet each other? So, ultimately you have a target, and you're going to have an actor. And he kind of walked through the discourse that might occur, and he looked for what he called failure points in those discourses that might occur. And when he looked at them, a lot of the failure points really had to do with the ability to be able to toggle attention or to toggle self-regulation. And what he tried to do is just to categorize these different events, and there was many categorizations that were out there, but one of the cleanest ones were to be able to look at cognitive self-regulation, affective self-regulation, and then behavioral self-regulation. So we'll kind of walk through those in turn, and we'll see what would happen when you're meeting someone from another culture. So when you meet someone from anyone, for that matter, in the first quarter second, what happens in your brain is you determine whether they're a person or not. Are they a person or are they a shovel? Because we process that stuff in different places in the brain. In the next quarter of a second, we process whether they are the same as us or they are different than us. And that's a big, big process that occurs in terms of the outcomes. Because if they're similar to us, we process the information much more deeply and we're actually paying attention to what's going on in the moment. If they're different than us, we process it much more shallowly and stereotypes can take over. So what comes out of that judgment that we make? In the next quarter second, we determine whether we like them or not. At an unconscious level, we make an affective judgment about that individual, all within less than a second of what's going on. So why is that important? Well, if we're going to get cross-culturally competent, we're going to have to actually pay attention to someone. So I've got to talk to a person to be able to do that. So I'm going to have to hold my stereotypes down and use my active listening and really focus on that individual so that I can be in the moment with them. Now, that sounds pretty easy to do. Those are just good interpersonal skills. But there's a problem that comes with that. To really pick up cultural nuances, not only do you have to focus on the person, but you have to pick up the context. And you have to pick up the ground to that figure. And that's a different kind of attention. When I'm paying attention to one person, that's focused attention. If I'm trying to pick up the background, that's diffuse attention. Those are competing systems. So if I'm really working on one hard, I'm not doing the other well. So rather than viewing cross-cultural competence as an overall level of self-regulation, like a working memory, this model views it as being able to smoothly toggle between focused and diffuse attention so that you're able to be in the moment with this person but also be able to pick up this background information that is quite important for you to be effective in the moment. So when we start thinking about cross-cultural interactions, a lot of the models were very static. They just assumed that it started. And that's fair enough, but you don't walk into the room with an empty slate. There's something going on with you when you walked in the room. There's some emotion that's happening. Could be positive, could be negative. And emotion has a lot to do with this ability to be able to toggle. What we know is that if you have moderate levels of positive affect, you're able to see the forest. And you're able to have global thinking. If you have negative affect, it tightens your range of your ability to think, and you get down into the trees. And even moderate levels can activate some executive functions that would allow us to look at wider alternatives, to be able to think globally, to be able to integrate thoughts, which is something that you've really got to do in complex situations. But it's tough to do when you start thinking about some of the things that a soldier is going to go through. You know, when I talk to you about those stories, a horrific story, one of the ones that was passed along to me was that because of a cultural error that had occurred in Iraq, there was a U.S. troop that was doused in gasoline and lit on fire. So I'm going to ask you to do something right now. I want you to close your eyes. And I want you to picture your best friend. Now I want you to picture your best friend on fire and dying in front of you. You can open your eyes now. How cross-culturally competent are you feeling? Be real tough to be able to do that. So you're going to have a lot of negative emotions that are restricting your ability to take in the big picture at that point in time. So emotional self-regulation is going to be really important. If you're going to be cross-culturally competent, you're going to have to at least keep it at a neutral level. And that's tough to do. And I'm sure you've all traveled around the world extensively. I don't know if any of you have ever been lost in a city where you don't know the language. And I'm not afraid of much in this world, but I got to tell you, it starts creeping into your head. Well, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know how to get home. And you get worried about stuff. What happens then? You start ruminating. You're locking in on things. And you're going to have to get that under control for you to be able to be effective in another culture. How about behavioral self-regulation? This is a really cool one. Gets you all the time when you're traveling. So the picture here is from 2010, where Barack Obama and Michelle Obama were traveling to Indonesia, and they met an Indonesian leader. And for those of you that are familiar with fundamentalist Islam, the teaching of Islam would say that you really are not allowed to touch a woman other than your wife. So this was a big deal in that part of the world. The Islamic world was really sort of abuzz, aflame, when this occurred. And the leader, and he had to kind of cover his tracks, had said he regretted actually touching Michelle Obama, but she initiated the encounter. And if you watch the video, that's not true. So he reached out and grabbed her hand. Why? I'm sure he had every intention of not touching her, but he's stressed out. He's talking to the most powerful man in the world. And if you watch the videos, he's shaken several men's hands before that. What happens? He just went and reached out. I do this every time I travel. I try to learn just enough language that I can be polite. So I could say thank you, I could say good morning, I could say good evening. I'm getting ready to go to Poland in a couple days. And at night, I should say do widzenia. But no, that's not what I'll do. I'll go, see y'all later. Have a good night. And you're like, damn, I've been studying this language for a long time. And I forget. And it just comes out because that's what you say. I'll have a good night. So, you know, this notion of behavioral self-regulation becomes quite important as well. Okay? So what does all that add up to? Well, what is one of the oldest Eastern philosophies or Eastern ideas we've had for a while? So I think good theory should bring something new to the table. But there's nothing new under the sun. This has been around for a long period of time. Just being in the moment and paying attention to what's happening around you and paying attention to your internal states and just making sure that you're taking it all in. I think that what Pat has put together has helped in this area of being able to operationalize mindfulness. So I don't think it's anything new per se, but it really has delineated some things and clarified a few points in terms of this notion of self-regulation. So let's get back to figuring out how big our fish is. When we start to think about the size of the fish, there's many ways that we could measure that. If I wanted to, I could take a blender and I could pop that fish in there and I'd blend it up, pour it into a cup, and that would tell me how big the fish is. And I used to do this during my presentation, but the front row would get all splattered and I could start getting some complaints. So I stopped. Now, why does that matter? Well, you know, it's Heisenberg's principle. If you measure something, you change something. And if I take this approach, it's not a fish anymore. Its fishiness is gone. It's goo. So when we go to measure something, how we operationalize it really matters. And we want to think a little bit about that when we're moving forward. So even if we pick the right constructs, sometimes the tool doesn't work very well. And Bill Gabrini did some work in this area, some DOD-funded research we did that asked us to evaluate all existing measures of cross-cultural competence. So we went out and we found what were 34 widely used measures. Some of them are proprietary. You couldn't really get your hands on them to evaluate them. And according to Bill, 5 made the grade in terms of having validity. A good friend of mine, Rich Roberts at ETS, said Bill was being kind, and a couple of those people in that 5 were his friends. So he cut him some slack. So the state of measurement in this area is pretty bad. And one of the main factors that I think makes it bad is that it's all self-report stuff. And self-report has a lot of problems. So some of these things that it's all declarative knowledge, it's all cognitive stuff. And if you ask me what I did and why I did it, I don't know that. Nobody knows that. We do stuff, and then if you ask me why I did it, I'll make something up that fits. We retro-engineer our experience. So self-report doesn't help us very much there. It doesn't pick up affective states very well. And then my first area of research in my career was faking. And these things are very susceptible to people managing their impressions. So they may not be an optimal tool to move forward and try to improve our measurement in the area of cross-cultural competence. What we have proposed is something that we're calling dynamic assessment. So if you think about the way we assess something now, the entire idea makes sense from a psychological perspective. We put people in the room, we have them fill out the same measures under the same conditions, and then if there are differences, that belongs to the person. But that's not what cultural interactions are like. There's a lot of ambiguity, there's a lot of complexity, there's a lot of change. So what we're trying to do is develop measures that mess with you and then see what you do. So this isn't really any different than an assessment center. So we're adding in a lot of interactive components to it, but we're doing it all online because assessment centers just aren't scalable. You know, if you want to assess the entire army, I can't do it one at a time, popping them into the room. So this dynamic assessment stuff is really fun. I'll give you an idea of what one might look like. So let's say that our theory holds water. We have a little bit of validity in the theory, that self-control is important. Well, there's a way that you can measure that rather than asking someone about their self-control. We can use a delayed discounting method. Delayed discounting assesses people's impulsivity. And what you find is that people that are impulsive will take a small reward now rather than waiting for a big reward later. So why don't I let them show that? I put them in a simulation with a local tribal leader who's playing a game of chance, and I'll let them gamble, and we'll see who's going to fall into those patterns. There's lots of other ways that you can do this. Bill's doing some really neat stuff with disgust. Implicit association test with disgust, which is a really strong emotion. So the idea is to be able to make these things more lively, more interactive. Okay? So that's the assessment side of it. How about the training side of it? Okay? If our theory holds true, one of the things that we know is that if you self-regulate, you get better. It's a muscle. It gets stronger. So what we can do is provide you with a workout partner or a training coach that prompts you to self-regulate prior to these particular events. And then over time, we're essentially training you and getting your metacognitive skills to where they're up to high speed, and you don't need those prompts anymore. So if we're able to strengthen those muscles, people are more likely to use those muscles at the end of the day. So it's been our goal to land the big one for a long time, and we're not going to give up. We're going to keep chasing the dream, if you will, so that at the end of the day, we're going to be able to help the U.S. military and help organizations that wish to assess cross-cultural competence and train cross-cultural competence so that they can ultimately be higher performing organizations. So thank you very much, folks. Have a great day.
All right. Well, thank you all to the three presenters. This was a really interesting and informative session. I'd like to invite you guys actually up. We have about a little less than 15 minutes for some Q&A. So for the audience, if you guys want to prepare your questions and start thinking of them, I have this mic if you guys want to. Well, so as you guys are thinking of your questions, I'll just start with an easy one. So the concept or the idea behind this entire day, as Kristen mentioned to start, is breakthrough and in sort of incorporating different disciplines and domains with iopsychology and connecting that and bringing that breakthrough to iopsychology. So traditional areas of iopsychology melding with different domains. You guys all have done great work in that. Obviously, we talked about it here. I just want to hear a little bit about your experiences, some of the challenges, opportunities that you have head working with different disciplines and how that's, you know, how receptive and how, you know, it's been with working with iopsychologists with different different disciplines.
Well, I could say that I'm thankful to the DOD also, you, Rich mentioned, who are really pushing the interdisciplinary envelope. I have on my staff now a computer scientist as a postdoc, a neuroscientist as a postdoc, and then I have many iopsychology graduate students and social psychology students. And it's been just a great happy headache, as Ben Schneider would say. I have a lot of gray hair from this experience, but I would say that it's been just, as the stereotype suggests, it's been, you know, really very intellectually enriching and productive in bringing in people from very different perspectives. So I sort of try to address broad questions about culture and then bring in anyone that has expertise that could help me get outside of my own box. So I think, for example, computer scientists have a lot to bring to the table in iopsychology because they can look at the conditions that might make a certain behavior prominent in a population using agent-based or other types of computer simulations. When I bring in people that are on the neuro side, I want to address also different types of questions with a different method, but they all kind of work together. And I think that the challenge, of course, is getting the right people who are really passionate about this, but I think that it can work when you really are all interested in a broad question and see your methods as really synergistic. And the other challenge, I would say, is also publishing. It's very challenging to get work published. You know, JAP doesn't, it's getting better, actually, in our journals. But, you know, a lot of times it takes a lot of persistence in finding the right outlets to get the right reviewers and so forth. But it's been a great ride. I would say it's definitely the wave of the future, funding-wise, but also for a field to really branch out and really reach out to other fields. You know, not everyone reads JAP. We don't tend to read Psych Review or publish in Psych Review, even our own psychology flagship theory journal. I'm guilty myself of, you know, I go to AMR. And so when you go to APS or other psychological associations and people don't know a lot about our psychology, I personally think it's a lot of our initiative where we need to step out and really educate people about what's happening in IO and then bring in people to these kinds of teams. And like I said, it's a happy headache, so I don't want to dismiss all the things about it that are time-consuming and agonizing, but that's my experience.
So we were talking about this a bit last night as well, and I lead a center now at Stanford that's dedicated to bridging theory and practice to solve social problems, but I have a previous career as a magazine editor and also in science museums. And something that I'm bringing from those different backgrounds to this particular position is how do you make a science that people want to use? And, you know, I've met with several different groups who are like, well, we're going to start a journal. I'm like, what? How many journals do you think policymakers read? I can give you a hint. It's a number less than one. And so really thinking about how do we package our science so that people readily understand it and want to use it. And I think Dr. Griffith identified a really interesting problem, which is, you know, we have these just a proliferation of measures that are not differentiable from each other by a lay audience, that aren't necessarily measuring the constructs that matter, and that really don't give actionable outcomes. We don't, it's like, great, okay, so you've just diagnosed me as having this, what do I do with this information? And so I think in creating a science that people will actually use, you know, first of all, the whole act of collaborating and collaborating well with people who aren't in academia, who are actually on the ground, that's an art form unto itself, is how do you bring those people into your fold and also into theirs? And then really thinking about what are the media that people most readily consume. It's probably not a journal article. My organization, we actually have an online searchable database of social psych solutions that are written at an eighth grade level. And then, you know, here's how you contact the researcher, and here's, you know, a consultant who can help you figure out how to apply this. So these are breaking through. It takes a lot of work and a lot of skill, but I think it is the future of all kinds of psychology, not just IO.
I'll agree. Just two quick points. I've never found an organizational leader that doesn't value IO psychology once they know what it is. And they'll often say, where do I find these people? And I'll say, well, I'll make you more. How many do you need? So I think there's a great value that we bring to the table when we communicate in their language. So that when you're speaking to an executive and you're talking about market share and how you can turn the dial on an IO knob that will increase market share, they'll listen to you all day long. If you sit around and talk about beta weights like a weenie, they turn you off immediately. So if we're speaking in their language when we're outside, and then when we're inside, we're cool with the kids in the club, and we can talk in IO language, I think we'll be more successful.
Great. Thank you very much. You have some questions? Go ahead.
It's a great question, and I think the first step is awareness of the different constructs, and obviously these are just, we're all playing darts here. It's kind of like you're throwing things at a board, and some things are going to get closer to the bullseye than others, and people are incredibly complicated organisms. No one or two or three constructs is going to thoroughly capture that complexity, as you've identified. But I think, somewhere between what we're all saying is this idea of paying attention to other people. It's like kind of, so we, in our work, we say, we have these two sides of ourselves, but, always lead with interdependence, because when you're being interdependent, you're actually paying attention to the other person and trying to figure out what their deal is, what kind of understandings they're bringing to the table. Similar concept of mindfulness, kind of paying attention to the situation, having a broad enough aperture that you're dealing with that person's and some pieces of their context. And then, bring to bear the knowledge you have. It's such a young science, I think, the science of cultural psychology or cultural science or IO, all of these are, this is not chemistry. We can't say this is the Krebs cycle going on in front of us, but I think we're all building up these toolkits. We can't really say what are the most important constructs yet, but I think just this, I don't want to call it a talent, but a skill of paying attention to other people and recognizing that something cultural is going on. This person isn't just a jerk, this is cultural, and I have some things to bring to the table. I think that's how I deal with the complexity myself.
I think this is a million-dollar question. I don't want to use the word framework because, like you said, all assholes or whatever the framework was. But I think that I want to say two things. One is that I think a lot of what we're saying is here's a framework. Like, I don't think Titus is the only construct in town, but what we're trying to say is, like, if you want to understand culture, you need to think about it at these levels, and here's a good illustration so that you need to understand where it comes from, how it manifests in everyday situations, et cetera, how it operates. We do work on honor based on some work in the DOD where we're giving people frameworks to think about how is a gain lost and stolen. And here's some examples from interviews in the Middle East. So we give people sort of a framework to think about it. They're not going to know everything. So I think frameworks, as much as they're faulty, they give you a gestalt versus a very specific fact. The last thing I want to say, the second thing, is that I've had this efficacy problem because I feel like it's such an enormously complex topic that I've hesitated to really reach out into the community. I'm in D.C. And I started to realize with this Geico commercial, you know, the 15 minutes can save you 15%, that I'm going to use that metaphor. You know, I'm going to reach out to people in the State Department, the Pentagon. I met with Van Hollen, who was the chief budget negotiator, to educate him in 15 minutes about what the last 30 years of negotiation research has said about what they're doing wrong and what they could be doing right. And I had a cheat sheet with 10 pictures. And I have no idea if that makes a difference. But I think that metaphor of you got to start somewhere and just distill what we do in 15 minutes. And it's not going to capture everything, but at least if we all are doing that, then that knowledge base will get out there. So that's my kind of my approach at the moment. But it haunts me as well that it's so complicated that we don't, what can we say? But we do have a lot to say, so let's do it in 15 minutes.
Yeah, I think she's dead on with that. The thing that we've tried to do is to, when we're speaking to other people, is to elevate the level of the discussion to the 30,000 foot view. And we had an event down at Florida Tech this past year where we invited in there were anthropologists, there were business leaders, there were DOD people, the academics of many different disciplines. And if they were speaking in their own language, no one could understand each other, so we had to bring it up a notch. And it was really fun. It was really energizing because you had people who had problems in the room and people that had solutions in the room. And if you could get them talking a little bit, then it worked out really well. So, you know, multidisciplinary approach that is a little higher level is helpful. Unfortunately, our journals don't let us do that. You know, there isn't a journal of 30,000 foot views on anything, which would be, if someone wants an editorial job, that's a good one for you. I think that would be a good place to start. Yeah.
Emerging area, so not much on either of those topics. And I think that there's some work that would suggest, you know, mergers and acquisitions, you know, some of the work on discretion and other macro level org psych work on tightness would suggest a lot of problems. We are starting to do more work on expatriation, but that still doesn't address your issue of biculturalism. You know, how do people who are trained to have a high impulse control, who are trained to fit in, then are dealing with a situation where there's very little guidance in the structure about how you should behave and what kind of risk factors happen when you're going from very constrained context to where things are kind of out of control in your own sense and how you kind of adjust to those contexts. Or likewise, what happens when you're used to a very loose, weak context but have to be in a very constraining context. And we have some data that we're presenting at the Cross-Cultural Psych Association on this. I can send you the paper on it. And it looks at, you know, the idea that you need, in a sense, a person-culture match in those contexts, that if you are coming from a tight culture but you have certain psychological affordances that help you in loose cultures, you do better. Likewise, people who are really open-minded going to tight cultures are much more socioculturally adapted. But the bicultural question is a really interesting issue that I'd love to talk further about.
Just to offer here, has done some really nice work on that particular issue. That a while back, and was, I'm sure Jisoo could fill you in a little bit, but there are some really neat findings in his work.
So we have time for basically one more question. I think I can speak on behalf of the presenters. They would be happy to answer questions offline, but we just have to get ready for our next presentation, so one more.
Thank you.
So the way we think, I'm Dr. Connor. Dr. Marcus is my colleague. That's okay. I'm flattered. She's wonderful. The way we think about this, or I think about this, is shame is actually usually thought of as a very interdependent emotion. Shame is about being ashamed of yourself because you're representing yourself to your community poorly. Guilt is a much more independent emotion, where sort of your internalized sense, you've violated your internalized sense of values and morals and ethics. So I would just map shame cultures and guilt cultures onto cultures that emphasize independence versus interdependence. Is there more, and people experience these emotions a lot, and they are emotions that help us perpetuate our culture cycles. These are our signals that we are going awry of what we've either been taught, our faces to our community, or what we've internalized. Does that answer your question in any sort of reasonable way? Okay, great.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I know, you know, Dov Cohen's work on honor, face, and dignity cultures speaks a lot to kind of this distinction of sort of your sense of self-worth. Is it something that can be easily taken away, or can it be stolen very easily? And that is more of has a direct analog to the sort of shame versus guilt emotional culture that reinforces those different cultural systems. In our data on the 50 states, we do find that the states that are the tightest are the South. Our argument is that most honor cultures are tight, but not all tight cultures are honor cultures. So I think there's less of a direct one-to-one connection between the construct of the strength of norms and sanctions with shame and guilt. I think they're correlated but distinct, because it's a much broader construct.
Well, I think we are just at time, so a big round of applause and a thank you to our presenters, and thank you to all. Thank you.
Thank you to our organizers who kept us on time, and great session, guys.